service.
The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis.
Amy Winehouse died at the age of 27, and she lived a life that routinely straddled triumph and catastrophe. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 2 was roughly the hour in the morning that she would routinely call her manager from the bathrooms of a handful of unspecified pubs in Camden looking for a ride, and also for help. Another 8 would be the number of songs it would take before a kickoff show for a fall tour went completely sideways and ended in disaster. 11 more would be the number of months between a victorious show at Glastonbury and a ruinous show at the very same festival the next year. 4 more would be the number of punches she would throw into the audience from the photographer's pit at the latter Glastonbury gig, when the screaming, heckling, and flashbulbing of 80,000 concertgoers became overwhelming. And 2 would be the number of years she had left to live when she was diagnosed with a disease so deadly she might need a machine to breathe. All totaling 27. On this, our third episode of season 4, Unspecified Pubs, Ruinous Shows, Punches from the Pit, and Amy Winehouse. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Nick Szymanski wasn't sure what to do. Fish or cut bait? Call or don't call? He was holding the phone receiver in his hand, and he could hear the dial tone humming its one-note song. And the flatlining sound taunted him. Fuck it. He'd call her. But he'd have to lie. Okay, well, not lie, but stretch the truth a little bit. Make himself seem a little more important than he really was. That was the name of the game. Any game that got played in the music business sort of went by that name. Fake it until you make it. Inspire trust even if you intend to break it. Walk into the room like you already have the job. All that positive, self-esteem inflating mumbo jumbo. It worked. And although she was only 16, word was that she could smell bullshit a mile away, even on the other end of a phone. That's what Tyler James said anyhow. Tyler also told Nick that her voice was incredible. Tyler was another teenage singer that Nick was working with. He was his quote-unquote manager. Okay, again, that may have been a bit of a stretch. Nick was only 19 and Tyler was just getting started, but Nick's family was in the business and he aspired to join the family business from a young age. He endeavored to do things that managers did, book the show, chase that other gig, pick up, drop off, create the opportunity, make the call. So Nick did what a manager would do and cold called the secondary school dropout with the incredible voice. Hello, is this Amy? Yeah, it was Amy, and who the hell was asking? The guy who was gonna make her famous, the guy who could open doors, that's who, motherfucker. Nick went big. He was Brian Epstein without the posh accent, Peter Grant minus the menace, Malcolm McLaren without the fetish gear. Amy was as advertised. She sniffed into her end of the phone line. Bullshit. But it was more than that. It's what she defined as bullshit. The industry, the biz, the money, the fame. She didn't want any part of any of that, so she hung up. But Nick called her again. He altered his tactic this time. He got more real. She hung up on him a second time. So he tried again. And by the third call, Nick had figured out that Amy Winehouse didn't need to be wooed with promises of wealth and stardom. And Amy had figured out that Nick Szymanski was a down-to-earth guy with a similar sense of humor and love for jazz, who could become an honest ally in a shitty business that was full of con artists and backstabbers. Soon after that third conversation, Nick received a package in the mail. It was covered in hearts and kisses stickers. Amy was written all over the outside, probably upwards of 100 times. Inside was a demo tape. Nick popped the tape in his car stereo. pressed play, and heard Amy singing the jazz standard Night and Day. She owned the tune, and that was it. She was even better than Tyler had said she was. In the following years, Amy and Nick were inseparable as artist and manager. He'd book the gig or the session and then literally drag her out of bed if needed, get her there on time. He was the one who reminded her to grab her phone, her keys, her passport. He carried a camera wherever they went and recorded video for posterity. A lot of his early footage would find its way into Asif Kapadia's 2015 documentary on Amy. Nick was there for the writing, recording, and release of Amy's first album, Frank, and they were making it up as they went along, the two of them riding the wave of acclaim and, God forbid, the tidal wave of fame that came along with it and threatened to come crashing down on all they had built up. Amy continued to insist she didn't want anything to do with that, so Nick helped run interference on the fame. But fame wasn't the only thing Amy Winehouse had to worry about. In 2005, Nick returned to London from holiday and everything had changed. Amy was no longer Amy, at least not the Amy that he knew. She'd flipped from one side of a record to the other, from light to dark. She'd veered wildly from the path that she had been forging with Nick and the person she'd met on that detour, a man named Blake. Something was off about him. Nick couldn't put his finger on it, but seeing the two of them together just didn't feel right. At all. And then the phone calls started. Not like back in 1999 when Nick was 19 and Amy was 16 and Nick was telling her what he thought she wanted to hear in order to earn her trust as a client. Now it was Amy calling Nick. 1 a.m. 2 a.m. 3 a.m. Nick's phone rang at all hours of the evening and early morning. "Nick, come get me," the voice on the other end of the phone would say. And Nick knew it was Amy, but it always sounded like someone else trying to sound like Amy. The Amy from one side of the record desperately trying to connect to the Amy from the other side. "Nick, come get me. I'm in the toilet at the pub." "What pub are you at, Amy?" Nick responded. The line went dead. Nick panicked. He hopped in his car, up and down Camden Town, scouring the streets for the pubs with their lights still on. Process of elimination. Sometimes he found her, that waifish body wrapped around dirty porcelain in a bathroom, and other times it was a fool's errand. The calls always led to squabbles, not just between an artist and her manager, but between two friends. Nick said Amy was in denial. Denial that, in order to fend off the pressures of fame, she'd become far too reliant on drugs and alcohol. Denial that, perhaps in order to live out some idealized version of what she thought a rock and roll star should be, she was romantically involved with the kind of person who would be her ruin. The kind of person who would only make things worse. And finally, just like Nick had long ago convinced Amy that he would make a good manager, he once again flexed those manager chops and convinced her to go to a rehabilitation facility. It was called Blue Water and was near where her father, Mitch Winehouse, lived. Nick also had buy-in from Mitch, who said that he would offer his complete support. Until he didn't. When Nick and Amy got to Blue Water, Mitch pulled a 180. "Do I really have to go, Daddy?" Amy asked him with that heartstring tugging tone that only the father of a daughter knows and only the father of a daughter cannot resist. "No, of course not," came Daddy's response. Nick and Amy had come a long way over nearly 7 years, but now Nick was back to where he started. That same feeling he had when he first rang her up all those years ago. He didn't know what to do. He was pretty sure that no matter what he did, it wouldn't help. He was also pretty sure that Amy didn't want his help. She made that clear with her biggest hit to date, released in 2006, that same year. The same year that Nick and Amy ended their professional and personal relationship. Whereas many listeners heard Rehab as black comedy or a defiant mission statement, to Nick, it was a diss track. Plain and simple. He'd tried to make her go to rehab, Nick, and she said no. Nick saw himself as the butt of a joke of that song. It was where his and Amy's story ended, but it was far from the end of the story. Nick knew that. He just didn't want to be there when the story reached what would surely be a tragic conclusion. crowd was agitated, impatient, packed like sardines inside Birmingham's National Indoor Arena. Showtime came and went. It was November 14th, 2007, and the opening night of Amy Winehouse's fall tour was missing only one thing. Amy Winehouse. She was late. The tardiness was an expected deal of the whole experience. It was part and parcel of the rickety Amy Winehouse package. But that didn't make it any less irritating to those who had plunked down a portion of that week's paycheck for a ticket. And by the time she appeared, some 30 minutes late, the audience was already doubtful that they were going to get a stellar performance. Amy walked on stage wearing a miniskirt and low-cut top. She clutched a glass in one hand. She knocked the liquid back and gestured for another round. The seven-piece band started up, and they sounded tight. Amy began to sing, and her jazz-inflected voice was the perfect foil to the steady backbeat. The crowd was momentarily relieved. Maybe it was going to be a great show after all. Amy opened with Addicted and then Just Friends and Tears Dry on Their Own. Each song sounded as good as the last, but the set list was long that night. 17 songs plus a two-song encore. There was still plenty of show to get through and plenty of time for it to go off the rails. Someone brought Amy another drink and another. Amy's mind trailed off. The crowd literally watched it happen. She stood still, looked straight up, and her mind just left. Gone. She dropped the microphone, picked it back up, took another swig. She tried to pull it together and dedicated the next song, Wake Up Alone, to Blake. That didn't work. That just made her cry. The next song, Some Unholy War, made her cry even more. Her voice was no longer the perfect jazz-inflected foil to her tight band's backbeat. It was that voice from somewhere, from out of the past. The one that came from radio static, but now it was its own static. Something pitiful, half-formed. The signal from the radio dying out. Amy stumbled on the stage and a roadie caught her. Blake. Her Blakey. He was all she could think about. She knew the audience had started to boo. She saw groups of the crowd turn their backs and walk for the exits. They'd all written her off, just like that. Not even half an hour into her set. She didn't care. She didn't listen to them. She kept thinking about Blake. Wondering if he was all right. Wondering when he'd be back. Wondering if he thought about her the way she thought about him. Just 6 days prior, they took him away in handcuffs. And the police had been waiting for Amy and Blake to return home to their Camden flat that evening. The same evening they had staged a raid when no one was home. Once the couple was back, the cops went through the motions all over again. Only this time they got what they wanted. Blake Fielder Civil in custody for attempting to pervert the course of justice. Amy wouldn't let him go, and the tears ran down her face and took eyeliner and mascara with them. She clung to Blake's arms, sobbing. The cops tried to peel her away, and they underestimated her love for him, her commitment. And Blake tried to play it cool. He was tough, tall, tattooed, trouble. He knew it, and they all knew it. He wasn't the crying kind. He let Amy do the crying for the both of them. A few days later, she'd gone to visit him in prison. More tears, more tough guy machismo emanating from Blake. He looked smaller behind bars. And now, back at the Birmingham show, Amy couldn't help but break down again. Blake's arrest consumed her. The crowd had gone from restless to pleasantly surprised to honestly not surprised and back to restless again. And very few of them were cheering her on anymore. And they booed, they jeered, they headed for the exits, and they wanted their money back. "Who's booing?" Amy asked. Her speech was slurred. She went to work on a fresh drink in her hand. She thought of Blake some more as she looked out on the dwindling audience in front of her. "To them people booing," she said, "wait till my husband gets out of incarceration, and I mean that." Tom Stone wasn't waiting around for shit. Not for Blake Fielder Civil to make bail, not for the next show on the tour, and not for anything. Amy Winehouse could go and fuck right off. And when she was done fucking right off, she could go and find herself a new tour manager. It wasn't that the opening gig in Birmingham was a disaster, though it clearly was. By the end of the set, it was hard to discern any of the words that were coming from Amy's mouth. And during the encore, which the audience hadn't exactly asked for, it was simply an expected piece of musical theater. Amy stopped singing in the middle of her version of the Zootons' Valerie, dropped her microphone onto the stage, and stumbled off as the mic fed back white noise into the crowd. The headline on the BBC News website the next day read, "Winehouse booed as tour kicks off." Another headline in The Independent read, "Drunken Winehouse heckled off stage at shambolic concert." Now, that show wasn't what had Tom Stone packing it in after one night. It was what he discovered at his doctor's office. "Something you want to tell me, Tom?" the doctor asked, sitting across from Tom in a sterile white examination room, routine test results in his hands. Tom didn't have the foggiest. There had been no major changes to his health as far as he knew, and he tried to keep it that way. Healthy as one could be, really, given his line of work. Sure, he was in the employ of Amy Winehouse, but don't compare him to Amy Winehouse. He didn't have the luxury to be burnt out on drinks and drugs 24/7 because he had to be the responsible one. Like Nick Shemansky before him, Tom had to get Amy and the crew from one place to another. He had a purpose, and it was to be reliable. So color Tom Stone surprised when his doctor told him the traces of heroin had been found in his system. And how the hell did Tom Stone get heroin in his system if he didn't do heroin? The bus. The fucking tour bus. Stuck inside that thing for miles upon miles, hours upon hours, while Amy and Blake smoked what they wanted. Tom tried to stay out of it. He didn't want to know if they were smoking crack cocaine or heroin back there. It wasn't any of his business. He was paid to make sure they got to the next city on time and kept to the road-weary schedule. He wasn't her handler. But Tom Stone couldn't keep his head in the sand any longer. There was heroin in his system. He didn't want heroin in his system. And there was only one way for him to make sure it would leave his system for good. He put the tour van in park, switched off the ignition, and walked away.
We'll be right back after this word.
It was the day after Jimi Hendrix died, September 19, 1970. Michael Eavis didn't have time to mourn the dearly departed guitar god dead at 27. Michael Eavis was busy worrying that he'd gotten in over his head. He stood and watched in horror as one of his hay wagons, the same one handed down to him by his father, went up in flames. He could hear the hay sizzle as the fire burned orange and blood red against the backdrop of a starry night sky. What had he signed up for? What had he done? He was just a dairy farmer. He knew cows, English countryside, stone cottages. The kind of pastoral life evoked by the music of bands like Fairport Convention and Pentangle. He himself loved music but didn't know music festivals. Especially not those on the grand scale of America's Woodstock from the previous year or closer to home, the Bath Blues and Progressive Rock Festival that had taken place earlier that summer just an hour up the road, with bands like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin spreading the gospel of electric urban music through the misty mountains. But how hard could it be? Michael called Pilton home, a village of less than 1,000 people in Somerset, and there was more than enough room to set up a stage at Worthy Farm. Bands could use Michael's farmhouse for a dressing room. How hard could it be? That was what Michael Eavis asked himself as he threw a plan together for what he would dub the Pilton Pop Blues and Folk Festival, a one-day event with about a dozen bands, free milk, an ox roast, and, as the handmade posters promised, films, freaks, and funny things. As Saturday, September 19th, approached, there was one particularly bad omen that Michael had to contend with. The festival's headliner, the Kinks, dropped out after they'd heard the concert described as a mere mini-festival. Ray Davies literally went to his doctor and got a note that said his throat hurt and he couldn't sing. Better than facing the humiliation of standing on a plywood stage and playing Village Green to an actual fucking village. So Michael scrambled and found two long-haired folkies with a Tolkien fetish willing to step in. Tyrannosaurus Rex joined a lineup that included Jethro Tull, Ian Anderson, as well as an English blues band called Steamhammer, whose members would later go on to play with groups as disparate as Rod Stewart and Tangerine Dream. The performances themselves were fine, and everything went smoothly, even if Wayne Fontana was a no-show, which to the assembled crowd of unlightened hippies was just fine by them. The sun had already set on Fontana's cheesy Game of Love horseshit anyway. It was the Hells Angels who brought instability, doubt, and fear to the weekend. The Hells Angels were the reason that Michael Eavis was standing in the middle of his field, his jaw on the ground, watching his hay wagon burn to a crisp. As the flames rose, Michael's heart sank. How hard could it be? This was how hard it could be. Michael Eavis hired the Hells Angels to work security for the festival. September 1970 wasn't even a year removed from the Rolling Stones' infamous Altamont Speedway Free Festival, in which an angel stabbed an audience member to death. And the Hells Angels did limit their damage at Pilton to non-humans, but it was damage nonetheless. And it wasn't just Michael's hay wagon. They stole the ox from the ox roast, which, along with the Kinks, was one of the two things promised on the festival's original poster that Michael now couldn't deliver. But the worst thing about that weekend was the attendance. Only 1,500 people showed up, half of what Michael Eavis had anticipated. For a dairy farmer with a dream, it was a serious financial blow. He didn't have enough money to cover costs. He lost all of his money. He bet the proverbial farm, and now he was afraid he'd actually lose Worthy Farm. Salvation came not just in the form of a sympathetic financial institution that saw promise in an idea, but also in the form of fellow organizers and collaborators who had the vision to take Michael's concept to the next level. And so, against all odds, the event came back the following summer, 1971, rebranded as the Glastonbury Fair, named for a nearby town that had its own fabled history with utopian movements. Decades later, Michael Eavis' mini-festival, The Could, had evolved into the Glastonbury Festival, a cultural behemoth that spread out over multiple days. It no longer attracted a mere 1,500 people like it did in 1970. These days, it was more like 150,000, some years even bigger. 300,000 attendees reportedly descended upon Pilton in Somerset, England for the festival's 1994 iteration. Every year, Glastonbury, by way of Pilton, transformed itself from sleepy farmland to a vibrant expanse hotbed of sound, vision, and possibility, even against the odds of its traumatic origins. Amy Winehouse was thinking back to her triumphant performance at the 2007 Glastonbury Festival. The place itself was magical. It was mythical, and not just because King Arthur is supposedly buried there. Any UK performer worth their salt wanted to play the multi-day music festival at Worthy Farm. It wasn't just the magnitude of the place. It was a stage where anything could happen, no matter the odds. Careers were made and remade in spite of the odds. David Bowie as a virtual unknown in 1971. New Order playing synth rock to confused bikers in 1981. The Smiths unwittingly egging on the hippies in 1984. And back in 2007, amid headlining performances by the likes of the Arctic Monkeys and the fucking Who, Amy Winehouse added her own name to a long list of artists with careers to make, odds to beat, and things to prove. In its rear view, The Guardian called her voice flawless and hailed her set list, which included not only originals from her two studio albums, but inspired covers of Toots and the Maytals' Monkey Man, Sam Cooke's Cupid, and of course, the Zootons' Valerie, which she had easily made her own courtesy of her frequent collaborator, Mark Ronson. And that was August 2007, a year ago. Might as well have been a lifetime. She thought back to the performance, to the way she was able to control her voice and command her band. It was a little victory that just happened to be won in front of 177,000 people. Now it was June 2008. Amy Winehouse was back at Glastonbury, but little victories were in the rear view. She looked out on the crowd and she saw a sea of hands holding up pocket-sized cameras. And they weren't paying attention to the music. They didn't care that the band was tight. She was giving them a shit performance this time around, and how could she not? Her husband was about to be sentenced to jail for his role in the assault of pub landlord James King and the subsequent attempt to obstruct justice. No, these people with their cameras aloft wanted to capture whatever happened next on video and then upload it to YouTube, put it on social media, or sell it to the highest bidder in the tabloids. And they were all little paparazzi wankers. They've been watching her story in the press all year. The video of her smoking crack. The video of her singing what amounted to a racist nursery rhyme. The attempts at rehab. The fights in pubs and on street corners in Camden Town. Her own home raided by London's finest. A seizure and hospital stay brought on by the stress of a life lived under a microscope. Amy Winehouse was a car wreck, and no one could turn away from it. So they kept watching. They kept their cameras rolling. Amy walked down from the stage into the photographer's pit, close to the audience, microphone in her hand. And maybe she could make a musical or emotional connection by also making a physical connection. She felt hands run over her body, voices screaming her name as she sang. Cameras rolled, lenses in her face, in front of her, behind her. She felt a tug on her beehive hairdo. Someone got a little too handsy and groped at her breasts. She swore she heard someone in the crowd talk shit about Blake. And that was the last straw. She looked out at the faces directly in front of her. Chose one, didn't matter who it was. If they yanked on her hair, or grabbed at her body, or insulted her man, any face would do. With one eye on the security guard shadowing her every move, Amy held the mic with her left hand and gave a quick jab of her elbow into the crowd. She felt to connect with someone's body, a shoulder, an arm, maybe a face, but it wasn't forceful enough. She knew that the security guard was watching her every move, but she didn't care. She also didn't care that her performance was being filmed, like most of the festival's performances, by television cameras. This on top of the many personal cameras hoisted in the air and thrust in her face. She tightened her grip on the mic, sang a few more lyrics, and when she reached a gap between lines, she balled up her right fist and sank it into the crowd. Once, she connected with someone's shirt. Twice, she whiffed. Three times, bam, a skull. That's what she was going for. The dull thwack of skin on skin, drowned out by the music and the crowd noise. She went in for a fourth punch, but at this point the security guard had stepped in and moved her away from the crowd. It was her against 80,000. Most would have bet against her, but she liked those odds. Especially at a place as magical and mythical as Glastonbury. And especially if, like Amy Winehouse, it felt like every day there was less and less to lose. Monday, July 21st, 2008, East London. Amy Winehouse wasn't in attendance at the Snaresbrook Crown Court. She didn't get to hear firsthand as a judge described her husband as cowardly and disgraceful. She didn't get to watch as that same judge sentenced Blake to 27 months in jail for the 2006 assault of landlord James King outside the Macbeth pub, along with the subsequent attempt to obstruct justice. The judge described the attack, which left King with metal plates in his face and indefinite therapy, as vicious and one-sided. Blake was drunk and high on coke that night of the attack. Now, standing in court in front of a judge, he was no longer high, but he was dry. Sober as the judge who had put him away. He didn't feel much of anything, to be honest. He didn't frown, didn't smile, didn't indicate that what was being said to him or what was being handed down to him had any effect at all. The way Blake saw it, he had already served 9 months on remand. If he acted on his best behavior, he'd be able to taste freedom in the next 4 or 5 months. Big fucking deal. As the courtroom staff led him away to his cell, he stole a glimpse at the small collection of family and friends who had gathered in the overcrowded public gallery. "I'll see you soon," he mouthed with his lips. It would not be soon enough for Amy, who felt Blake's continued absence more than anyone present at the Snaresbrook Crown Court that day. She had been luckier than Blake when it came to her own case of assault. The man she'd clocked in the head at Glastonbury opted not to press charges. "At the end of the day," he told Daily Mail, "it's all part of being at the front, to be honest with you, and being crushed by thousands of people here at Glastonbury." At the end of that day, Amy Winehouse just wanted to get as far away from people as she could. People. All those fucking people. She coughed, her lungs burned. She felt a tightness in her chest and wondered if another panic attack was coming. She continued to cough and her lungs burned even more, which reminded her that her night wasn't over. In some ways, it was just beginning. She climbed into a helicopter on the outskirts of the Glastonbury Festival grounds and flew directly to the London Clinic, a private healthcare organization on the corner of Devonshire Place and Marylebone Road. Unlike her previous stints in rehab, however, the London Clinic wasn't treating Amy for drug addiction. They were treating Amy for an early onset of emphysema at 24 years old. Her father, Mitch Winehouse, had broken the news to the UK tabloid The Sunday Mirror earlier in June. Her lungs were at 70% capacity. She may need a breathing apparatus just to get around. He said that doctors had urged Amy to quit smoking everything, from cigarettes to crack cocaine. That if she continued to smoke, it wouldn't just destroy her voice. Her life was literally on the line. She vowed to get clean. "Don't worry about me, Dad," she reportedly told Mitch. "I know I've got to stop taking drugs now." Mitch had heard that one before. Everyone had. Even Amy had heard herself repeat empty promises on the regular. She had to want it, a reason to get better, to stay alive. She hoped that Blake was behaving himself behind bars, that his release would come sooner than later. They said he was no good, that he was a major reason why she was addicted in the first place, but she disagreed. Not her Blakey. Seeing him again on the outside, that was something she could work towards, something she could live for. Whether or not she could actually do it, only time would tell. And whether or not Amy Winehouse knew it, time was something that was most definitely not on her side. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. The 27 Club is hosted and produced by me, Jake Brennan, for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer and co-producer. This episode was mixed by Matt Bowden. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker and Henry Lunetta. Story and copy editing by Pat Healy. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. Talk to me on social at Disgraceland Pod and hang out with me live on my Twitch channel, Disgraceland Talks. For more news on your favorite podcast, follow at Double Elvis on Instagram. Rock-a-rolla.
What's up for your ears?